Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review. Joining me today is my girlfriend Juliana. Say hello.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about another Ian M. Banks book. That's right, we're continuing on with our Ian M. Banks Culture Series read-along. The whole point of this is that we're reading through the list of books in order, not in publication order, but in our order or my order, because somebody asked, what's the best order to read them in? And because I don't think it starts off with the best book, and I don't think it ends with the best book, or the best place to start and end with the best place to start. So the order that we're doing is Player of Games, Consider Phlebas, Accession, Use of Weapons, State of the Art, Inversions, Matter, Surface Detail, Hydrogen Sonata, and then Look to Windward to finish off. So, we last time out, we did State of the Art, a novella and a short story collection with three culture novels in. You enjoyed those ones, didn't you? No, culture stories, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And, you enjoyed those ones,
enjoyed it, yeah.
And this time out, we're going to be talking about Inversions. And do you have anything to say about Inversions, or should we just give a quick summary? Not a quick summary, let me put it this way. We are, because this is a read-along, we are now presuming that you have read this book as well, or are reading along with this series. So we are going to go into, as we go through, full spoiler mode, full spoiler territory. And this is a book where a lot of the enjoyment comes from discovering things yourself. There is mystery elements, or there are many mystery elements in it. You know, there's people dying and you've got to work out why people are dying. There's different characters. You've got to work out the connections between the characters. And of course, we're going to be talking about those connections and mystery things as we go through, because they're very important. But you enjoyed this book, yes, Juliana?
Oh, a lot. Yes,
me too. I very much enjoyed this. This is, for me, a great book to read again. So I do suggest get this book as an ebook or as a paperback book or as a German translation book, because that's what Juliana had, or even an audio book by, there's a great narration by Peter Kenny that you can get from Audible. So, or other places, I'm guessing. So check out this book, and I'm just saying that straight at the front. If you don't mind spoilers, well, continue listening. We're gonna do more and more spoilers as we go through, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think you have to do, like, if we talk about the book as we do, you have to do spoilers, especially in that book. There's no way that you can avoid spoilers.
Why not? I think you. I reckon.
Inversions?
I reckon.
Really?
Yes, of course. I reckon I could do a very good thing. But again, like, I would only do no spoilers for what I experienced, you know. Like, I would read some stuff in this book and go, well, that's not a spoiler, that's really obvious, but you, like, made a note, like, 127 pages into a 400 and something page book, you're like, oh, look, this thing, and I was like, oh, yeah, I thought that was quite obvious, like, in chapter 3, and you were in chapter whatever by then. So, yes, there is a different number of spoilers as you go through, different revelations as you go through. So, yes, anyway, read this book. So, should we get onto the discussion about the book and what we like about this book and what we don't like about this book?
Yeah.
And why we think this book is good. So, of course, this is a read-along, but if you've not read the book, or if you've not read the Culture Series, if you're just, like, dipping into this podcast and seeing what it is, Ian M. Banks wrote the Culture Series, and it's a big space opera thing. All the books take place on many worlds in many spaceships, and, you know, it's galaxy-ranging stuff.
And drones.
Now, yeah, there's drones and spaceships and
mines
in the spaceships, and they're all, like, high-level artificial intelligence, massive energy manipulation, faster-than-light travel, everything like that. Now, the reason I did these books in this order, I put these books in this order, is because I think that Inversions goes with State of the Art pretty well, because in the previous book, we get the viewpoint is the culture insider looking at Earth, but we also get it kind of bit the other way around. Like, what would Earth, like, what would we see, like, if we saw these culture people, these special circumstances or contact people, if we saw contact people walking around on Earth, would we be able to recognize them as aliens? Like, and that was a question that comes up in State of the Art. You see someone walking around, and it's all like, oh, but if you get injured, they'll be taken to hospital, and you've got extra organs, and you've got two hearts, or, you know, whatever the, and there's one person is like, well, I look more like a Yeti or an abominable snowman,
like a
big furry thing, and he could pretend to be the Yeti going along, you know, through the Himalayas or something. So there's that thing, like, okay, what would it be like? I mean, of course, that question isn't explicitly addressed, that what would it be like if a human level civilization, a human level, I guess, a civilization, what do I say, like a planet, you know, with human level, like normal 20th century level technology, would we be able to pick out aliens orbiting the Earth?
Yeah.
And I think to get around that, kind of get around it in a way, in that the that it didn't seem totally out of the question with state of the art, is that it was set in the 1970s, you know, so it was a little bit before all the technology that we have now. Yeah. Of course, it was written a while ago as well. But these days, if you think, oh, well, I mean, of course, I say this, the plane went missing. We can't even find a plane. So, yes, I'm sure a spaceship could probably hide from us in a way. But so, yeah, there is that question that comes up, like, how would people on a planet who don't know the culture exist, how would they interact with a spacefaring nation that came in, like the culture to, or special circumstances comes in and the contact unit comes in and makes contact, what would it be like for them? And that's what this book is, Inversions. It's told completely from the point of view of two different people. The first person is very obvious. It's a doctor's assistant, and it turns out that the doctor is from the culture. I think that's pretty obvious away.
Really obvious right away. From the beginning, yeah.
The other story is written from the point of view, but it's actually quite interesting that at the beginning of this, of was it chapter 3 or chapter 2? Let me just see if I can find it. There's the prologue. And then the beginning of the second chapter starts off with, I can't find it. I'm flicking through here. So it says, this is the story of the man known as Duwar, and I've chosen to tell the story after the fashion of the Jaritic fabulist, and that is in the form of a closed chronicle in which, if one is inclined to believe such information for consequence, one has to guess the identity of the person telling the tale. And I really love this storytelling device that you're like, well, who is this story? Like, who, like, and that's the thing, who is the viewpoint of this story? Is it Duwar? And they say, well, it couldn't have been Duwar because, you know, at the end of, we all know that at the end of the story, this happens, or would it be this? Well, we all know it couldn't have been that person because this has happened at the end, you know. And they actually says, you know, it says here, if one's inclined to believe such information of consequence. But actually in this book, I think one of the clever things is it doesn't, there isn't a lot of consequence there. Like, it's actually open to interpretation who is the person who has written this, the story of the bodyguard.
Duwar. Yeah.
Of Duwar's story, of the bodyguard. Was it Duwar? Was it, because they actually say, the story actually says here, what is it, well, it actually says, you know, judging on, you know, it's only a small part of his story and stuff like that. But the idea being that we find out, of course, at the end is that there's two different endings to this story, and depending what you want to believe, yeah, it actually changes your opinion of who wrote that story or which character within that story is meant to be the one who is telling that story. So who do you think that is? Or did you not think about it that
much? No, let me put in one thing. At the English hardcover version.
Oh, yeah.
At the beginning, what you don't have in the ebook and what you didn't have in the
audiobook.
There's a note on the text.
Yeah.
This text, in two parts, was discovered amongst the papers of my late grandfather. One part concerns the story of the bodyguard to the then protector
of Tessessen.
Of Tessessen.
Yeah.
One,
Erlaine.
And is related.
It is alleged
by a person of his court at the time, while the other, told by my grandfather, tells the story of the woman Fossil.
Yeah.
And blah, 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 blah. So the overall, like, there's a person saying,
so there's a frame story. Outside the frame story is another frame story.
Exactly, exactly. So, and that obviously the grandfather who wrote down the Vossil story must have also got the other story.
Well, it actually says that in the prologue. It says, I have included here another story. I'm not going to tell you why I've included this other story, but you'll be able to work it out for yourself as you read through.
Yes.
So, yes, we have these two interludes. But bring it back to that.
And also it says here, about the doctor, who may
or may not
have been from the distant archipelago of Dresden.
Yeah.
But who was, without argument, from a different culture.
Yes.
It actually says it there.
Yeah, it's quite an obvious, was from a different, wait for it,
culture.
Yeah, so, it is a... there is that question, and I think I understand why they took that out, because it's too obvious. I mean, the whole point is that, so the Doctor is definitely from a different culture, but what about these other characters? Which of the other characters are from a different culture or from the culture? And are they from the culture, or are they from special circumstances, or are they from... contact, or what's going on here? Yeah. As well. So, to bring it back, who do you think wrote the bodyguard story?
Maybe the bodyguard himself.
You think it was Dwyer himself who wrote it?
Why not?
Well, I think it could...
Let me put it this way. There was this third person.
Perrin.
No. You know, when he's telling the story
mm-hmm.
about the two cousins, there was this third person...
Oh, yeah.
Mentioned.
Yeah,
never mentioned again.
Yeah, she was mentioned.
Yeah, but maybe she was like a drone. And maybe she was there all the time.
No, because the drones, they wanted her affections. In other words, they wanted to, you know, to be become lovers and stuff like that. I think that's just an illustration to show that, hey, we're all free here. And we'll get into that a bit later as well. Mm. I think, of course, the three people who could have told the story, one is Perrond.
Yeah.
One is Dwyer. And the other one, I think, could actually be the young prince who survives at the end. And it's actually said to him that he continues on and reigns a bit. But I think he's too young, but he is one of the main focuses of the story. So he could have got those same stories.
I would actually think of the two people there you just mentioned, mm-hmm. Latins would be the most, the more reasonable one, because Perrond is actually the one in the end position who's going to die. And if she would have died... She wouldn't have been able to write down this.
But which story do you think? Do you think she does die at the end of the story? Do you think that Dwyer and her go off and live happily ever after and set up a trading stop and things like that?
I actually think this is the most likely one.
Yeah.
But, if she would have been the writer, why should she write and like I don't know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it is of great consequence. But I do like the idea that this we're not meant to know who survives through to the end or what's going on. Yes. And I quite like the idea that he goes back and becomes a prince in his own land.
Yeah.
So cool. we're kind of skirting around the edges of some of this. What the main story is, of course, you've got in this medieval place, there's a doctor and a bodyguard. The chapters switch between the doctor's story and the bodyguard story. And in each of these two stories, there's like three characters. There's the main, like the main character, the person that they're protecting, which is in one case is the king, or in the other case is the protector general. And then the person that they have their main relationship with, in one case it's the bodyguard. The bodyguard has a relationship with Perrond, who is a concubine. She's someone in the harem. And then the doctor has a doctor's assistant. Called
Ulf.
In the audiobook it's Ulf. It's like a kind of like Ulf. Like a French pronunciation. Hey, yeah. Ulf.
So in German you would just think it's Ulf because it's just an umlaut, just with a O E spelling.
Yeah, so it's Ulf. There's the female doctor, Ulf, her assistant, that's definitely him telling the story. Yeah. But of course, there was a mystery in that story as well. Who is he talking to? Who is he addressing it to?
And because he is writing this down for a master.
Yes. So who do you think the masters were as you were reading through? Like, go through your reading process, your response as you're reading through.
At the beginning, I didn't have no clue at all.
Yeah.
At one point yesterday evening when I read it through, there was the point when I thought, maybe it's Dwyer himself. That would have been really clever because, you know...
So you're thinking that Dwyer had someone planted with the doctor to keep...
To keep in touch or to keep in knowledge what she's doing.
I think there are hints early on that it's actually someone who is very close to the king.
Yeah.
Who actually wants to protect the king because he's saying, oh, when the king looks so magnificent, he had this big shaggy hair and he had this great frame of a man, you know, who was like a great king. He's really talking up. So it feels like he's writing reports to somebody, and it's like, well, this person is the fan of the king, is going to be looking after the king. The intrigue on the doctor's side of the court, nobody wants to harm the king. but they all want to harm her, if you know what I mean. They think she's threatening the king in some way.
Yes.
So they're all loyal to the king. Whereas in the bodyguard story, they're all trying to get the protector. They don't really care about Dewar himself at all. It's purely the protector that they're going for, you know, when they went out hunting and they get the arrows shot past him and things. So we've got the doctor and her assistant and the king, whose name was Adlaine? No, what was the king's name?
Quience.
The King Quience. And well, let's talk about her story. What did you enjoy her story there? Some highlights of hers, of that story?
Some highlights. Oh, the highlight, one of them for me was when she went... Olaf told that he didn't really know about the story, but it came to him later when she went for a swim in the lake. Yes.
And the bad boys come along and try and grab her and rape her or something.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really like a good cutoff because it cut off at the point. Like it was pretty much like a TV series cutoff.
Yeah.
She pulled over her shirt over her head and was hidden within the shirt, and then they came from behind.
Boom, yeah, and I really like it that their swords had been twisted around and tied a knot in a sword. Yeah.
So also I like this because there's no real like harmful violence in there.
Yeah.
Of course, she's obviously beating them up, but there's no.
But she understood that they weren't the people that she needed to worry
about.
So
there wasn't a huge amount of battle going on.
I know it's weird to say this, but the violent punctuations in her story are the things that I really enjoy. For example, when they're going to that other palace and the one of the dukes, I can't remember which one of its which of the dukes dies, but it's a sealed room, nobody goes in, nobody comes out, and somebody dies, and there was somebody who was
he's seeing a dark bird.
Yeah, like a dark bird flew through. Oh, I saw this dark bird. And of course, it's a knife missile, which we know and love from other culture books. Yeah. But the knife missile, I really enjoy because it's this dagger that she puts in a boot and it's got these jewels around the top. Jewels on the top of the dagger. Yeah. And when she's explaining, oh, it's this old blunt dagger, but it's very precious to me. It's helped me through lots of scrapes. And these jewels here, these gemstones, whenever I've been in trouble, those gemstones have helped me get out. And of course, this is my second time reading this book. Oh, I forgot to mention that at the start. This is only my second time reading this. And it was maybe 10 years ago, maybe more actually, since I read this book. Let me check when this book was written. I'm sure it's right here on the Wikipedia
1998.
So I probably read this book in maybe 2000 or 2002 or whenever, you know, whenever I was going through and reading all the culture books that had come out at that point.
Yeah.
And
so it's my first read.
This is your first read through.
Yeah.
But here, like I remembered some of the scenes and I remembered some of the story, but there was a lot that I hadn't remembered, you know.
Yeah.
And the first time you read it through, you don't understand what's going on. Like, for example, you didn't realize that Dewar was from the culture. He's not so special circumstances.
Not until the sixth chapter.
Yeah. But I knew both of them were from the beginning, so I picked up on a load more clues, a lot of more little references and things. And this is something that I didn't pick up on last time when she says, oh, the gems have got me through some difficult situations. And of course, the first time I read it, I was probably just thinking, oh, yeah, and when she needed to pay for something, you could take these gems off.
This is what you are supposed to think.
Well, that's what a Welsh thinks.
Also, she says she needed it to wave about with it in front of other people.
To brandish the knife in front of
So
what she is doing
really funny.
Is that she uses this knife missile just to go off and kill people that she doesn't want.
Yeah,
and
chopping heads off. Other bits, stabbing.
There's the torturer that she kills.
Is there somewhere a list where it says this is all the people she
kills? No, she kills Nerletti. Nolietti, who was the and his
one duke's,
which was the torturer, and then
the one duke,
yeah, and then she also Duke Wallen.
I think he was the first one, wasn't he?
No, Duke Wallen. No, yeah. No. She kills the torturer, And then she kills Duke Wallen, because Duke Wallen is, or Lord Wallen or whatever it is. No, Duke Wallen. He's the one who's trying to find the person who's meant to be from Dresden to see if she is also from Dresden.
Not Dresden.
See, she's also from Dresden. And she knows that Wallen is trying to catch her out, you know. So she knows at that point that she has to brush up on all her Dresden stuff and Dresden language and make sure that she has everything. And I'm never quite sure that when the guy from Dresden does turn up, she says she had this blank look on her face, and then suddenly she smiles and they went off talking
and
like
I
that.
And I had the idea that there must be a point where she, like, something told her in her ear or something, that she had a translation device.
Yeah, in my head, in the way that I was looking at it, it's that moment in The Matrix where he's, like, up on the roof and he's like, I know Kung Fu. Oh, no. Yeah, when they're downloading all the fighting, and then he goes, I need to learn how to fly a helicopter. And then it's like, actually. It's Trinity who says that. And she goes, right, now you can fly this helicopter. And she gets it in that kind of blank look. I'm like, oh, is that what's happening there? It's like, I need to know Dresden language and where this thing is. It's like, and it all just zaps down into an implant in her mind.
But also it obviously builds up, like, the tension there, because all these people, they try all the time to get her into a trap. Yeah. And the Lord, Duke,
Wallen.
No, the other, Ulriziel, which was the guy, which was the guy who obviously, because he was, because she didn't take the mask that he offered her on the ball, and she pushed him away. No, how's it called? She didn't.
Rebuffed him. Was that the young?
Yeah, that
it was
the young one.
Yeah, he
and
took the blame.
He then also came to the court with that guy, having like a very, like, a victorious face on him, saying, like,
yes,
now I can prove that she's fake.
Yeah.
And then there's this.
It's the other Duke Wallen, wasn't it? It was the older. Well, it was actually the younger brother, but they said that he looked older because he always had a frown on his face. Yeah.
And so when he saw that she had the blank face, he thought, yes, I won. And then she started, like, talking.
Yeah.
And it was really funny. But it was quite obvious to build up the tension to.
But again, why was that pause there? Because if she really was there, she would have recognized it straight away. But she knew that there was going to be that coming, because they found the transcript. Of course, the little knife missile, which is this the tool which has got 1,000 uses. Yeah, and then at the end, when she uses it, Ralph closes his eyes, and then he opens his eyes, and there's people's brains everywhere.
Yeah.
And he actually says, and there was some of the gemstones, so they'd obviously been knocked free. And I'm like, no, they didn't knock free. Those are little pellets, because they shoot out and explode, like, cut
in
three
people's heads.
Yeah, the knife missile itself, which I guess it is a knife missile, but, like, how it's obviously not very intelligent, because we know from the drones that they have to be a bit bigger to have a brain.
Yeah.
But she had to give it some instructions. If there was a drone nearby, the drone wouldn't have needed instructions. So I think she's there without a drone.
Yes,
just
I think
the
so
knife
too.
Missile.
And also, I think she has no transmitter. How are they called? The little thing that they have.
No, I think she. They always have a little. What do they call it? No, it's not transmitter. Like a little transponder thing.
Transponder thingy.
No, what do they call it? I don't know.
Like Dizzy Sma in State of the Art, she has it in a little
brooch. Yeah. Anyway, a little token that they have, which is a radio contact back.
Yeah,
so
contact
the ships,
back to the ship. Or
yeah,
something.
The ships can always get into contact with them. So that is cool. Those scenes are really good. But also, just I really like the interactions that we have with the king. And in the end, she's fallen in love with the king a lot earlier. But, you know, we find out that, yes, she has fallen in love with the king. But the king, as I was reading, is a really nice guy.
Yeah.
And it seems a bit like, oh, it's a one-dimensional that he's actually, you know, the king.
What do you think how old he is? It was really difficult for me to have a picture of him and his age.
Oh, you know, I was thinking like he was like 40 or something like that.
Yeah.
So he was pretty mature. He knew what he had to do. You know, he was doing a good job. He was in control. You know, like there was the protector over there, because the idea being that there was a large empire, and then the empire broke apart because, you know, some meteor strike from the sky or something.
Yeah.
And I think it was actually that meteor strike from the sky was probably the thing that got the culture involved in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't have got involved.
And also that was mentioned so so often.
What, the sky falling in? Yeah. And I was just thinking, is the sky falling in, I know this is just my own speculation, but was the sky falling in, I reckon that could have been a part of the war, you know, the Adiran culture war. Like, so the culture kind of felt responsible for accidentally bombarding the planet, or, you know, some stray munitions sounds came, good. Something like that. Sounds I'm not good. Sure if it is that. I'm just saying that is another way that it could, because otherwise you'd be like, why is the culture, like, getting involved in this, you know, medieval society? That seems a bit too, not quite advanced enough. They should probably be waiting for the technology to pick up a bit and then, you know, see how the society evolves by itself. But they're already involved. Special circumstances are already involved in a way that I'm not quite sure why, you know.
Yes, exactly. There's one thing about the planet where when I read the book, it didn't feel at all. Like, if you don't know about the culture, this book is more like a medieval crime story, whatever.
People fiction. Say it's like a fantasy book, but it's not even a fantasy book.
It's not
book.
Fantasy. There's nothing fantastic in it. There's no magic at all, except for the culture people.
Yes.
So it is more like a medieval fiction thing.
Yeah.
But the whole time through, they are humans.
Yeah.
So you're on a planet somewhere, and you talk about another species or another people, different.
Yeah, again, you've just got to understand that Ian M. Banks doesn't write about humans. He writes about humans. He writes about what humanity is, not this specific species.
No, but this was very specifically human.
Why do you say that?
Because they had boobs, they had penises, they had
all of these culture things. I think you keep getting caught up in the words that Ian M. Banks applies to humans.
People, these people wear dresses. They have long red hair, and the description in this one really is very human-like.
That is the science fiction trope that you just have to go with when you do space opera. You have to just presume that, like, what about Star Wars? Why is Star Wars? Why are there humans in Star Wars? Like, what about Star Trek? Why has every planet got people who look exactly like humans on it, except for maybe some different wrinkles on their foreheads or different shape ears? You know, you just got to go. That is the convention of fantasy. It is the convention of Star Wars, like all of every single space opera just goes with it. You just got to go with it. The only way that you can get around it is by saying, well, there was once a species and it spread through the stars, but you can't, that doesn't work either, you know.
Yeah, but if you would have said, like, at the beginning, oh yeah, and these people, they all have blue skin, they don't wear anything.
But you don't need that. Why do you need that? That just gets in the way of the storytelling when you come to space opera.
Fantasy. They actually talk about what they wear, how they look like, and they look very human-like.
It's convergent evolution. That's it. I can just say convergent evolution. Like, that's the reason why.
I really think it's like very well. It's very set up in.
So what you think this is in a future Earth. Future
no, it's
Earth?
Not future. It's just a different Earth.
Yes, and that's what the culture does. It goes around and connects together all of human-like civilizations and invites them to join the culture. That's what the culture does.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a big galaxy out there.
If you wouldn't be humanoid, why would you fight
the rules
with
of
swords
the rules
and...
of the rules of culture, the culture books, the rules of the world that Ian M. Banks has written is, it's a space opera world. You're going to land on planets, and lots of planets are going to have very similar evolutions, and you're going to end up with basic human stock. That's just the template that life builds up into on all of these different planets, and it's made very clear that all humanoids are pretty much the same size. They've all got two legs and two arms, or some of them have three arms, you know. They've all got, you know, they've got different numbers of joints, they've got different numbers of fingers, they've got different teeth, you know, different, but it's all, the differences are superficial. And for storytelling reasons, he skipped over all of the differences. He talks about them getting on mounts rather than on horses. But a bird is still a bird, even though there's not a specific bird. They didn't say, oh, it is a blackbird, it is a sparrow, it is a kestrel, or something like that. They don't say those. It just goes, this is a bird. And the things that they ride aren't specifically equine horses.
There's just one animal mounts. They're hunting, which is not an
it's a deer. But it's a deer analogue, you know.
Yeah, but it's,
So I think you should not get caught up on that. So
Well, it's really difficult for me to get...
I just wanted to say, oh, my laptop's making a funny noise. Hopefully that doesn't go on too long. So one thing that I did notice that I that I liked about this is that the Doctor, when she falls in love, you can actually see yourself falling in love with someone like that. You can understand that thing, and it's a really great scene where she goes, "Oh, I told him I loved him," and then she couldn't let him do back, and Oelf is going, "Oh, but now I want to tell you that I love you, but this is going to be really awkward."
And then she says, "Oh no, I can't give you back what you give me, like just like the king with me." But I must admit, at that point, it was a bit cheesy.
I don't mind cheesy. I think Ian and Banks earned the right to be a bit cheesy at that point.
Yeah, that was obviously, it fits with the story.
Yeah.
But it was cheesy.
I don't mind it being cheesy. He's already spun it into a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And someone's going to have a fairy tale ending and someone isn't going to have a fairy tale ending. So anything else that you want to say about the Doctor side of the story? Because then we can skip onto Devoir and then we can talk about how they played with each other.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. But you enjoyed the overall story with the mystery and things.
Yeah.
But I love there's like, you think, oh, it's going to be a murder mystery. And then you're like, oh, the protagonist did it. Like, it was Vossil all along. Well, we've done so many spoilers. You can't do it. It's like, she was the one who killed everyone.
Yeah. Very clever way.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying that the murders that you found out, everyone's going, oh, how did this work? You know, the Doctor was here and whatever. But I just love it that she killed the Duke with her knife missile and then goes in and tries to save him. And it's like really trying really hard to save him. It's like, oh, that's really good that she's really trying to save him. And of course, she was the one who just killed him, but then came in and tried to save him as much as possible. Why? Yeah. The only thing that I think is a bit weird that she kind of goes, I need to go and meet this at the very end. I need to go and meet this person in this room over here.
Yeah.
And then she just goes and does it. And I thought, like, did she know that she was going to be set up? Did she know that she was going to her doom? At that point,
of course.
At that point, I don't think she minded too much because she realized that she'd messed up with the king.
Yeah.
But also, she'd already kind of done her job. You know, the reason why her job was to, you know, to set the king on the right path and, you know, take the power away from the dukes and stuff.
She wanted to get rid of the last person that was a bad influence.
Yeah.
And then she saw, okay, my how is it called when you say my confession to the king wasn't very successful, didn't really work. Well, let's just go.
Mm-hmm.
I think she knew in a very dramatic way.
Yeah, but I think she knew her job was coming to an end anyway.
Yes.
And by getting into a situation, because you kind of see she goes out and she comes back and she goes, better just pick up my knife missile. And she puts it back in her boot and then walks off and you're
she
like,
she knew exactly what was going
to She already knew happen. She was going into that situation. Okay, so I just thought...
Okay, let's talk... let's go to Devoir.
Devoir. Devoir. The war.
The war.
Okay, so... What I really loved about this story is that as you go through, you realise that the Doctor is there on officials. I say official. As official anything can be in the culture, which is all just done by, you know, hints and remarks and, you know, unofficial committees and things like that. But she is there on special circumstances business because it says at the end, don't disturb me. Oh, no, I can't remember what the last quote is when she leaves the ship. You know, she's sailing out and her cabin is found empty.
I'm in special circumstances.
She pretty much says that she's in special circumstances. But what I like about Duwar is that he's not part of the culture. He's left the culture and he only went to this place. He only went to this planet, which they've only just discovered is round or something. And, you know, they thought it was flat for a while.
Some people still think it's flat.
Yeah. But they're like, I only found out this, I only went here because my cousin, my friend was here. And maybe if I go there, I'll be able to catch up with her again. You know, so it's like he knows he's not there on official business. But does anybody else know he's there? I don't think he's got a knife missile. He doesn't have his little, Star Trek communicator to say, buzz me up. Yeah, transponder to say, beam me up, Scotty, and get him out of there. No, it's just him. He's just there. On his own initiative, and we've seen that before in Use of Weapons, where he goes off and he lands there and he's like, oh, and I'll give the life-extending technology to this guy and this guy, and they're like, oh, no, you've messed it up. Oh, man, there's going to be war. Yeah, man, you fucked it up really badly here. But with his personal philosophy, which has been tempered by, you know, we find out in the backstory sections, that he isn't getting involved. He is just there not to do. So anyway, say some favourite bits or some favourite factors like that, or things that you like about Dwar.
The first thing was when he told this little story to Latins. Is that his name?
Yeah, he's not really a prince. He's just the protector's son. Yeah.
And he tells the story of two cousins.
Yes.
Living together.
Oh, we're going directly to this point, are we? Yes. Okay, let's do it.
Because this was the first point where I thought, okay.
Well, Sacrum and Hiliti.
Hiliti, whatever. And so it was very obvious. There was this boy and there was a girl.
Yeah.
And the girl had the idea to go somewhere and interact, to make everything better. And
where they were saying, oh, it's like a game. We were arguing about the rules of a game.
Yeah, exactly. And Hiliti was more of a defensive one, but still aggressive.
Yeah.
With no trust to nobody.
Yeah, didn't trust anybody.
Don't trust anybody. And then while the book continues, the story also gets more and more detail.
Yeah, he keeps telling these fairy stories. Yeah. And of course, as a fairy story, they're not very good fairy stories. I mean,
no,
actually, to
really
be honest,
bad.
The first one he tells is actually really good. I love the opening story. He says, oh, and there was this prince in a castle. No, an emperor in the castle. Yeah. And he got his architect to go in there. And the architect, you know, and then he killed the architect or tried to kill the architect while he was in this room. And I really love that. And this time when I was reading through, I was like, oh, he thought he'd killed the architect in a room, but then the architect disappeared and he was found somewhere else. Now, if you realize this is actually what happens later on,
yes.
You know, they think they killed someone or, you know, they try and capture someone, but then they manage to get out of the room. And that's what's happened to him in a way. Like, he's obviously been, someone thought he's died somewhere, but he hasn't died. He got out and escaped and is now living somewhere else. And they're like, oh, is he out there? Someone's out there. It's like, oh, we've heard you're out here. You know, I know you by your works, your architectural works and stuff.
Yeah.
And you actually realize, oh, that's the kind of thing that's happening here. It doesn't only happen where, like at the end when the doctor escapes from the empty room and they're like, oh, where did she go? Oh, she's gone. She's disappeared. Which is a great echo from the start of the book to the end of the book.
Yeah.
But also, I kind of feel like he's the architect in a way. He got out of the culture by going somewhere and people thought he was crushed under a rock or died somewhere. But no, he's actually still out in the world and doing fun stuff.
Exactly.
Maybe.
And also, why he is telling the stories to the little boy. What?
Oh, I want another grape. Oh, okay. I want you to pass me a grape.
So he's telling the story to the little boy and the more stories he's telling, the more comes out these two cousins. They played like
played pranks on each other.
Pranks on each other, exactly. And all of these pranks repeat in the overall bigger story. And this is
why I thought
so awesome.
I thought we weren't going to go straight to this point. Okay, I wanted to talk a bit about Dwar and some of his things. No, let's just skip over it. Okay, Dwar's pretty cool. He's a good bodyguard. What else do you want to say? That the ruler that he's protecting the protector, which I quite like, is the protector general who kind of took over, killed the king, took over what the king was doing, but didn't want to be called a king, even though he is a king.
Yeah.
But he's kind of an emperor because there's other dukes that are under him.
But they revolt.
Yeah, they're revolting against him, and there's war going on.
Sometimes I thought he was a bit too inactive. Like
very passive.
Very passive. Like so passive. Oh.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, you don't have to shout that quite that loud. Yes, but very passive. And sometimes you're like going, well, why? Like even when he saw like these two dukes or whoever they are shoot arrows at both him and the king, he didn't just take the king aside and say, look, your brother and this other guy over here, they tried to kill you. Didn't you realize they tried to kill you? And later on, they were in the bath and they're all talking, you know, there's some of the guys in the bath.
Say that one like, is telling you, oh, and your arrow went pretty close. Didn't
yes,
it?
But I was shooting at the bear, the bear analog, not shooting at and your one went even further. And you're reading this stuff, and you're like, why doesn't he just tell the king, look, okay, don't do this? And all the time I was just thinking, well, why doesn't he just take over? He obviously knows exactly how to win this war.
Exactly.
He knows exactly how to get rid of this guy's political opponents. So even though he's a very good bodyguard. In some ways, you know, you see him save the king's
life
a few times. You just think, no, you've got to be more you've got to be more involved in that. And that's what comes down to this big argument between
Hiliti
and Sakroom. Sakroom and Hiliti. That Hiliti is like, no, you don't trust anyone, stay out, don't get involved. And the other one is like, no, you got to get involved. But at the beginning of the book, and this is why you said, you asked me at one point, it's like, oh, so, whereas you're still reading, so Hiliti is the bodyguard and Sakroom is the doctor, isn't it? And I just said to you, of course, I knew it was the correct, but I just said, but it's a culture book, so you don't know if they've changed gender. You know, you don't know if they've both had a sex change, and which one of, or if they swapped round. And you were like, oh, and I know that's not exactly true, but it is one of those, again, a fun thought experiment of a book like this, especially in the culture, because we know from Accession that there was, you know, there's a thing where the two people get together and then they both become, one of them becomes a female and impregnates one, and then one, and then the other, they switch things and they do the other one, and then they both become females, and then both gestate the babies at the same time. You know, you get that, backwards and forwards thing that know it can happen, that they in both situations they can both be male and female and then back to male again.
But here they didn't.
Well, yeah, no, I don't think they did. because we do know that, you know, at one point, and there's the backstory about them both falling off the waterfall, or one of them falling off or being thrown off the waterfall and the other one jumping off the waterfall. Yeah, and Sakroom says, she has a scar above her left ear. And later on, we find that doctor does...
We never.
Vosil.
No, we don't. Because there's this point when the torturer is shaving her head and he looks on her head and says something.
Yeah.
It's never pointed out very clearly.
Let me have find this note.
She has a scar.
Okay, so here we have. Hiliti came too quickly and mightily revealed to see his friend. Sakroom's head wound was not as bad as it looked, though to this day she bears a funny triangular scar on her head where the rock hit, just here above the left ear. Luckily, her hair covers the scar. That's mentioned like halfway through the book. Then we get to the end. So he says, Relinge, which is the thing, he says, ran his hand, he's the torturer, ran his hand over the doctor's head, and at one place over her left ear, his hand stopped and he looked more closely, muttering in a soft voice something which I could not make out. But he's just chopped his hair off. He says the hair covers the scar, and then later on he talks about the thing over her left ear.
Of course. I noticed that too, and I wanted you to mark that, but it never says it specifically.
So what is, then later on, what was the other one? I'm sure there was that's the little white beads around the top of the dagger. I mentioned those before around the knife missile. Anyway, carry on what you're saying about that. Anyway, you got these two backstory. You got the backstory about these two, the cousins, and of course, one of them is.
Oh, what I wanted to say, the pranks.
Oh yes, they play pranks.
They are not like just like children's pranks. They wanted to teach each other something.
Yes.
And in that one big prank where it is about the rock and falling down into the waterfall.
Yeah.
Hiliti is trying to teach Sakroom not to trust anybody, even
don't trust anyone,
the closest friend.
Yeah,
exactly. And this comes so good.
It comes back to bite him so much.
Exactly. And there we come back to the title, which is Inversions.
Yes.
And I really, really, really like this whole complexity of this whole story, which. Because he is not trusting anybody, but the one person he is actually kind of trusting turns out to be...
Who?
Perrin.
Oh, okay, yeah. So this is the thing that I really love about this book, is that this whole thing, the whole book is a prank.
Yes.
That Sakroom, or Vosil, the doctor, is playing on Duar, Hiliti, in return for this waterfall prank, because it was just before that all happened, and they, you know, they kind of made up, oh, we all made up, oh, this is really good. But of course, Vosil, she's in contact with the culture. She knows that Hiliti, or Duar, is there on the planet. And this whole thing, of course, she's got her own orders and things that she's carrying out. She knows what she's doing. But it's like this whole thing is her playing a prank back on it and going,
oh, yeah.
You said not to trust anyone.
Anybody, yeah.
now the closest person, and I'm going to... This whole book is her pushing Duar off a waterfall.
Yes.
Even though it ended up good, depending on which ending of Duar's story that you want.
Yeah, yeah, but as in the little story that Duar is telling, I think the not killing Perrin is the more likely one, because in the little story, the both of them get together again.
Yeah.
Because
Perrin and
Hiliti and
Vossil.
Sohru.
Oh yeah.
Because there's the other one where they are underwater and she's trapped there, mm-hmm. and he gets her the little stick.
The mouthpiece. The blowpipe. Yeah.
The blow thingy to save her life, and this gave kind of back the trust,
yes.
between the two of them.
Yeah.
And this is why I think in the end story, Perrin and Duar,
yeah.
he's not going to kill her.
No, because there's that he thinks even though there's been a big betrayal of trust,
yes.
you can still make up,
yes.
and do this thing. So yes.
I think so.
So what we have is this kind of morality tale being played out about, like, what is intervention good? Should you teach people a lesson? Should you, the whole idea of, like, why... let me put it this way. Why do you torture somebody? Go.
To get information.
No, never.
I know.
The reason you teach.
People say when they torture somebody, they say to get information.
There's actually another Ian Banks book. It was actually sold under both names in different territories. Mm. Transition. It's all about, one of the main characters is a torturer. Mm. And it's very clear in that statement, and in lots of other science fiction books that I've read that include torture, is that torture is not to get information. Torture is punishment. Like, you've done something wrong, we need to punish somebody,
Yeah.
We don't like you for political reasons, we are going to do you harm in a degrading way,
And most of the time, people who torture actually enjoy what they do.
Well, I'm not saying in this book, in this book they do, and they're good at their jobs, and that's fine, that's no problem at all. But in the same way, like... Why do you torture? You torture to teach somebody a lesson.
Yeah.
Why do you teach somebody a lesson? Is it for their own good? And that's what the question is. Like, the doctor teaching? Is the culture, is special circumstances getting involved in this planet for the planet's good or its own good? It's like that. It's this big continuum from torture at one end to assassination to just interference with a culture. And of course, Hiliti or Duar is very much on the other end. It's like, no, we will not torture, we will not do this. He's against we will do this for your own good, we will interrupt for your own good, we will do this intervention for your own good.
And also Vossil convinced the king in the end to not torture one of the guys.
Yes.
He normally would have tortured.
Yes.
He would have,
But she would torture somebody, no problem.
No, she's not torturing.
No, but she would.
Would she?
Yeah. I mean, she kills the torturer. Kills these other
people. She's killing people so quickly that it's not torture.
Yeah, but what was she doing to the king? What was she doing to the king's child? What was she doing to Duar?
To the protector.
Yeah, to the protector. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. What was she doing to the protector? Yeah. To the protector on the other side, which comes down to the big reveal at the end, the main connection that you find between them, is that it's actually been...
No, she is torturing Duar.
And the child and the king. Mm. She is bringing the king... And this is why... This is one of my favourite things about the book, is that when you actually get to the end of it, the king, what is it, King Quience?
Yeah.
King Quience, the one that the doctor's looking after. And this is another reason why I really like him, and I think he's a great character. He's not a complex character, but he has it in at one point he's talking to his his war thing, and they're going, oh, is it his dukes or whoever he's talking to? Yeah. And they're saying, oh, we've got to look out for this protector over there. He's going to do this and going to do that. And he's just like, no, don't, we not need to attack. We don't need to attack. And this young kid is going, yeah, I'll go over there and start fighting. It's like, no, you don't need to do that. We've got to do something. He's like, I've got it in hand. I've got, I don't know if that's exactly the words he says. It's like, I have this in hand.
Is that the king is saying it? Not Edlaine or something.
No, no, it's the king, Quience, is going, I have it in hand. Okay. You don't need to worry about the protector. We've got a plan worked out, and the plan is, of course, that we find this later out, that Perrond was discovered by the king and probably Vossil at the same time. I'm not quite sure, but anyway, Vossil has been making some, because the hints are dropped through that her and Awelf are working on different things. It's like, oh, and these are the damaging substances, and these are the poisonous substances, and we bring them all together, and we've got to store them in the right place. And it's only when that it kind of feels like that they get back to this, they made this batch of poison before they went off to the summer palace, and then they get back and it's like, oh, I've got to make some more of this poison because I've got to get to that, you know, to that hospital and give it to this, is it like a religious order, or give it to these mothers or these nuns, and they're going to deliver it across. And at the other side, Perrond is going to go along to that place that she's never been there. And she was like, oh yes. And I need to go back here. I want to visit back here again. And Dora was like, oh really? Well, how long are we there? And she was like, I was there for a week. And I was like, that's suspicious. Like, how does this place that she was only at for a week, how does that have such a strong hold on her? Why does she think that she has so much of a history? Yeah. Turns out she didn't. She was just there to pick up some poison to give
to the son of the protector. Yeah. And also, Perrond is also telling her story. And all the time that you think, the protector got her out of that situation and all that stuff. But
I never thought that.
No, I didn't either. No. But this is what she wants all the others to think.
Yes.
But all the time I was thinking, it isn't like as she's saying.
No, it's not. So it's not that clear. But she even says, yeah. I told this story to the protector's son, but it was actually the opposite of that. You know, it's the opposite. And you think, well, if it is the opposite, like is the happy ending is the opposite as well. This is not going to be a happy ending. Yeah.
But you think, why didn't she kill, like, she had contact to the protector all the time? Like, I mean, she was his concubine.
No, this is the whole point. And it actually says this, that the king is saying, we can't just kill the protector. We can't go into battle against the protector.
Yeah.
It has to be shown that the protector system, he killed the king and he's taking over and it's not a monarchy anymore. And he's literally saying, we can't let the common people, because the protector was like a common folk. He'd come up in the army, hadn't he? He was a general. Yeah, he was a general, but he was a professional general. He wasn't a hereditary general. He wasn't a landowning duke or something like that.
I don't think so.
And they said, we have to bring him. We have to see his protectorate fail from the inside. Yeah. We can't have it. Of course, we know that he probably was influencing the war with the dukes and all that kind of stuff. But from it had to fail from the inside. We have to show that this guy, if you're not born to be king, if you're not born to be a duke, we've got to show that a common person isn't good enough to come up and lead. And that's what they did perfectly. They used the son's illness, completely destroyed him, and then killed him off. In a way that it might even look like he asked his own.
So you think that the king and Vossil did that together?
Yeah, it was the king. Yeah, it says, well, maybe it doesn't say exactly, but it's pretty clear that it wasn't the king's men who raped Perrond. It was the protector himself and his men.
Yes.
And the others have died, but then she only had a few more to kill her.
Was she raped? Oh, I thought she was hidden there in that thing.
Yeah, but she had watching to, her. Oh, yeah, family. She had to see her be raped and killed or whatever it was. Yeah. But yeah, so she wanted revenge for that, and I think it was the king, the charismatic king, who came in there, swooped in afterwards, and was like, ah, okay, you're wandering around, you want revenge. Tell you what, go over there.
You get it.
we will put you in this hospital, and we have the connections in this hospital with the nuns.
Yeah.
They hated that the king, the old king, has died by the protector, and they ain't going to do that. You know, it's a lot of political. But what I loved about this book is that you can read all the way through this book and miss all these connections the first time. You've really got to go, okay, I'm going to think of every single two characters in this book and work out what they would gain from working together, or what they would lose from working together, or like what... would these two people work together for a common goal or against each other for a common goal?
And where are the connections?
Yeah, where are the connections? But you can do that with, like, all of the dukes. I know it's a bit difficult to tell them apart, but you're thinking, well, okay, well, the brother of the protector and this other guy, could they be working with the king? Like, who is the master?
Could they be working with the Edlane or the other...
And then you're like, Uelf is there. He keeps writing these reports to his master. Which side is his master? Is the master this guy? Is the master one of the dukes on this side?
On any side, or is he just somebody who is actually just looking at it?
Yeah, watching.
Just watching.
Who is his master? Yeah, there's so many different ways to look at this. So what else were we going to bring back? There was So we pretty much, this is the weird thing, we've pretty much just talked about the plot and what's going on. And for a book where I didn't even remember very much about the plot, there was a lot of layers to this. Every time that you peel it away.
So many layers, yeah.
And that's why I don't understand you were saying before. You were like, this feels like a writing exercise when you're looking through these Goodreads reviews.
Somebody says, this feels like a writing exercise.
But for a writing exercise,
why somebody would say that.
But you're going to say, we read it in a deeper level than other people have read it, the story-wise.
Because it is... it is more complex than you think.
I think it's very complex.
I can understand when people say, this looks very much like somebody who wanted to put in as many layers as possible. And
I think you did very well with it.
You did very well with it. But I can understand if somebody who has maybe not the knowledge so much about the culture could just see the writing level of...
Yeah.
That there is something going on, but...
Okay, so let's get into some of the writing, not the plot-wise, but writing-wise. What I really, really loved is that there's loads of... Like, every time that the story switches, there's a link to the story that we've just been reading, like the chapter we've just been reading, and they switch back across, and there's a link to what's being said in this next chapter, or what's being described in this next chapter. I made a note of some of these. Like, there's at one point where we mentioned before about... it's actually one chapter directly after each other, where in one of them... the knife missile kills the Duke, and Vossil, the doctor, goes in and tries to save him by blowing air into his lungs, you know, and people are going, why are you blowing air into his lungs? The very next chapter, we get the story of them falling off the bridge, the collapsing tree across the bank. This is Sekhrum and Hiliti, and Sekhrum's trapped under there, and Hiliti is going down, and he blows air into her mouth to keep her alive, and then puts the thing in. And I was just like, I know it's just a small thing, and it's a game. It is definitely a game that Ian M. Banks is playing with us as a writing exercise.
Yeah.
I did something very similar in my novel Combat. It's an A-B-A-B-A-B storyline.
Yeah.
And I made sure all of those were in there,
connected, that they
were connected. And people were going, they don't really have a strong connection. But I really love the thematic connections. There's another great one. I mean, these are just a few that I had here in my... that I made some notes about. As well, when Vossil is describing Dresden, where she comes from, and they say, it sounds like you're describing a fairy tale land. And I think that's hilarious because, meanwhile, over in the protectorate of Tatasin, she's saying, I'm from Dresden. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. And meanwhile, this other guy is like, I'm from this fairy... No, he doesn't say, I'm from this fairy land, but he describes a fairy land.
There's the storyteller then, where everybody is happy.
Everybody is happy, and everyone's got enough to eat, and everyone does this, and everyone can fly, and they can swim without, dying, and all that kind of stuff. And I just love the idea where someone says, you're describing a fairy tale land. Meanwhile, Dewar is describing a fairy tale. And they're both describing the same place. In other words, the place where they came from, the culture. And this just goes on and on and on, and that's why I really love this switching backwards and forwards between these things.
At the beginning, I thought actually that this Dresden doesn't exist. Does not exist as like a physical.
Oh no, it thing. Is. But it's like saying, where are you from? I'm from Timbuktu, meaning the most remote place in the world.
Exactly. But I really really enjoy this these like setting up things about. Oh yeah, and in that Felicia, how is it called in English? The fairy tale land of
the fairy tale land
that Felicia.
It was Philly. Called. You keep talking. I'll quickly look it up.
He's telling about this, and and there, people are happy, and they talk in a different language, and you couldn't really translate the language, and not even what they. How they live, you couldn't really translate that into the language, and people wouldn't understand it. This is also what always comes up in the culture novels, that people, you can't translate certain things into the specific language. This is what he says about
Levitia.
Felicia?
Lavishia.
Lavishia.
Yeah, if something is lavish, it means there's lots of it, you know, Lavishia. So the culture is like the land of plenty, Lavishia.
And in German, it's called Felizien. And
meaning a lot, yeah.
No, Felicitas. It means happy.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so it's a funny translation thing, but that is a point.
Happy land, yeah.
Happy land kind of thing. And,
And also, just there are, I know this is weird to say, but the other day, this year, I read or listened to the audiobook called The Inverted World by Christopher Priest. And I read through some of the reviews that people have done on that. It's like, oh yes, and there's lots of inversions. There's this and there's that. And you inverted expansion. And this is called inversions. And you have a similar level, actually many more inversions. You know, like we've already talked about, like the characters, how they're like, there's every situation is an inversion. One is a king. One is the person who killed the king. They've got this over here. They've got that over there. One is fighting a war. There's a doctor who tries to save someone who's like a preventative thing. And then, but
sometimes
actually a doctor.
Killing people.
Yeah, no, she says prevention is better than a cure, and you're just like, well, you shouldn't be a doctor, then you should be a bodyguard. Ah, you know, that kind of thing. That's what I'm trying to say. It's like the bodyguard is preventative, the doctor is
active.
Well, you know, reactive. One of them is active, one of them is reactive.
Yeah.
But then you actually look at it, you go, well, actually, as a bodyguard, he is very reactive and is never actually doing anything proactively. And then as a doctor, she's doing lots of stuff proactively to protect herself and the king by just fucking killing people who get in her way. It for me, it gets into one of those like, oh, and now let's look at the more tricks that Ian and Banks is playing on us by like how many inversions. And he goes, oh, they went to a ball and she was wearing a mask. And what was
mask was with a mirror.
Yeah, and the mask was a mirror or whatever. And then and also the mask of the mask that he was trying to give her. It's like, oh, this mask is very valuable, but it's not very valuable, so I can give it away. But it is very valuable. You know, that's, you know, the other guy who's trying to give
her
it.
Who then after that turned, he inverted into somebody who was against
her, which was quite obvious. Yeah. And then, but also Uelf as well, his mask, it actually says on one side it was smiling, and then on the other side it was frowning. Sad, you know, it's a sad, it was happy on one side. And he says, well, I guess it's meant to be like the old comedy and tragedy masks or something like that. I think he even mentions that it was meant to be comedy and tragedy of the, like of the old empire arts or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, well, and it's just in that one scene of this masked ball, it's just, you know, it's like a demonstration of, well, how many opposites can we get?
Well,
how many
and then things... first she's like very beautiful, has very beautiful long red hair.
Yeah,
and at the end she's bald.
Yeah, but I was specifically...
Like a warrior.
Like in any one specific scene, you get this thing. Oelf himself is
all
in everything.
All the time you have inversions and...
But like I say, it does become a bit of a game, and in the end it just becomes like, it just washes over you. Like, you know, that scene that you said before, it's like, oh, and these guys went into her and caught her, and it's like, oh... And I would have fought to the death to defend her honor, but also I would have wanted to see her naked as well. It's like, oh, damn my eyes and damn my monkey brain.
Yeah, yeah. It's really cool. So, one question about the title. I like the German title of this book. It's just the straight translation. It's called Inversionen, and the title inversions, do you actually use the word inversion if something is like changed?
Yeah, well, you can, like, it's like a mathematical transformation or something.
Yeah,
you know, like when
it's
you
probably
have
more like a technical term, like,
yeah, it's more of a technical term.
Maybe in German too, because Inversionen is not really something, I mean, you understand what it is,
yeah,
but it's not at all something you would use.
No, that's fine.
you would more use a different...
So let's get into this writing bit. Like, how was the German translation this time out? Because you read some Ian M. Banks in English and you read some in German.
I think it was really good. It read... the read-along was really cool. I read the first first 100 pages and then stopped one evening. And then in one day, I read like...
You were ill in bed
All the rest of it.
Yeah.
And so really a good read-through, easy to read, not very complicated, not very... Because you don't have the level of ship minds sending messages where you have to kind of decrypt it or something. So it's
you've
got
to pass out the conversations between ships.
Yeah. So it's very straight. It's very much like, as I said, like a medieval criminal story thing. And you're very involved and you always think, who is it? Who is it? And you feel very clever once you worked it all out.
But, that's more of the story writing rather than the translation. Language. But the language is good. I actually really enjoy this because I have this as an ebook, and I had the audiobook version that I got from Audible as well. Peter Kenny, again, he's done all of these... No, not all of them. There was one which I listened to which wasn't by him, but it's good. And I started off when I just read it as an ebook, and I was like, well, you know, I've got the audiobook already. I can listen along and see what it's like. I thought, well, there's not lots of, like, he's got so many great voices, like of all the drones have different voices, the ships have voices, the different people and the aliens have different voices. And in this, I was like, well, is that really needed because there aren't ship drones? But actually, it really helped out because... The narrators had different voices. When he was doing Uelf's voice,
really?
He put on kind of like a young voice. And then when he was doing the Dwar chapters, it was kind of like he had a slightly different accent.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, the accent that he chose to tell Dwar's part was similar. It had a similar tang to it than as it has a similar, it was similar to Vossil,
Doctor.
The Doctor.
Yeah.
Even though Dwar didn't have any accent like Vossil, but it was like, oh, so is the person who wrote the Dwar's story, was it Vossil? Does Peter Kenny think it's Vossil or someone from the culture? Or does it, you know? And anyway, and the other thing that helped quite a lot is that the King and the Protector had different voices, and the Dukes and things, they all had different voices.
That's pretty cool.
Which helped out a lot because some of these, because there's so many Dukes on different sides, like, oh, wait a second, so the Duke on this, what is the General on that side? They've got a bodyguard, and who's the guard commander? And, and it is a little bit tricky and sometimes, but the different voices did help out in that way.
What I just can say about the writing is that there was no things that came out where it repeatedly.
There was no things that
repeated. You know,
Words.
Yeah, like repeated words or repeated forms of saying like certain things. Like,
oh yeah.
And then he despicably did that or whatever. I'm not really sure what I'm saying here, but like, there's no.
Repetition.
No repetition of using certain emotions or and then he sighed, and then he sighed.
I didn't notice that. Actually, though, in one point, I did spot a mistake, a repeated line. This often happens when they're editing an audiobook. Someone will do, of course, more than one take on a line.
Yeah.
Like, for example, none. Oh, no, sort of like, what? They had no war, famine, pestilence, taxes, Perrin asked. What? They had no war, famine, pestilence, taxes, Perrin asked. You know, like that. Oh, yeah. You know, there was two takes on the line that just popped up. I didn't make a note of when it happened. Maybe I should have done, but I didn't do that. Anyway, if you are thinking of reading this book, which you should do.
Yeah, you should. It's good.
It's very good. What you should do is read this book, or even better, another way you could do it, except just buying an ebook or buying the normal book or buying a German translation, is go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and get it for free. If you've not signed up for a trial yet with Audible, do so using the SFBRP link, which is the audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and you get this book free. Or any book free for a month. And if you then sign up, you get one book a month on the gold plan, or what I do, I have a platinum plan, which is $2 a month. And there's like 200,000 audiobooks, thousands upon thousands of science fiction and fantasy audiobooks. And I definitely do recommend Peter Kenny as a fantastic narrator. And this culture series is fantastic. So help out the SFBRP, help us pay our rent. Well, it's more help us pay our own the books that we get, and bandwidth and other website stuff for the podcast. That's actually really handy. So that's check out Audible.
And if you if you have problems finding it, just go to your local library.
It might be there
because this is what I did. Yes. Got it from the library.
So let's just talk a little bit about how this fits in. We say definitely read it. Do not read this as the first ever
culture novel. I mean, you can, but you will miss a lot.
You just won't get it. I mean, actually, put it this way. If you got this far into this podcast, we maybe should have mentioned this at the beginning. Like, yeah, read this book. Don't read this book as a first...
I think we did mention it.
I know I didn't say don't read this as your first ever culture series book, because it just doesn't... I just don't think it would work. You would get some story, but I don't think you understand the power or the ideas. You know, we only know about this because we've just read State of the Art. So we know that there's a conversation. Do we contact bring in a planet? You know, should it contact the planet and say that the culture exists and invite them to join?
What is the right thing to do?
Yeah, what is the right thing to do? Mm. This has been a conversation right from Player of Games, Consider Phlebas, or this is a war story, you know, Accession, not so much. But yeah, like Player of Games, Use of Weapons, State of the Art. You've got the different viewpoints of the different characters, and you know what special circumstances will do. You know what contact does. You know, in some ways, you know that contact will contact a place, like in Player of Games, and then just fuck it up from the inside intentionally.
Yeah.
And you realize, oh, it wasn't contact all this time. It was special circumstances, and it wasn't a contact drone. It was a special circumstances drone. Mm. And so you need that kind of idea that, like, the philosophy behind the culture and the conflict. Yeah, the conflict within the culture and special circumstances to what to do with planets. You kind of need that background to understand what Vossil, the Doctor, is doing there, and even what Dewar is doing there as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's very much needed. So, that's just what I want to say. Next book in our culture read-along series is going to be Matter. We're going to do these next three in publication order. Matter, Surface Detail, Hydrogen Sonata, and then we're going to finish off with Look to Windward. So Matter is the one I actually wrote here when I was doing this, when I was laying this out. I said, Matter, this is probably the most minor culture book in the series, in my opinion. It's okay, and that's about it. At least after Inversions, it'll get you back into the swing of spending time with ships and drones.
Okay.
You know, after,
that's cool.
After Inversions and state of the art.
Yeah.
It'll get us back into it as well. I actually quite liked Matter, but let's read it
and then we see how you feel.
Yes, but I'm just saying, like, this book was one of those ones that I was like, I don't remember very much about that. But now I read it a second time, I'm like, this is awesome. But I had exactly the same thing when I read Use of Weapons the first time. I was like, oh, that's good, I guess, but it didn't really grip me. And then the second time through, I was like, oh, this is the best book I've ever read. And then the third time through, I was like, this is still absolutely amazing. And I've had that same experience with Inversions that I had with Use of Weapons. Like, first time through, oh, that's okay, I guess.
Do you think you would have the same with Matter?
No, I don't. But I think there is going to be stuff in Matter.
More into it that you didn't see.
I might see a bit more into it, but it felt just much more like an adventure story. You know, there's the different...
Don't say anything. We will read it.
Okay.
And then we will make
So that's
another...
for the future. Oh, man, we've gone over an hour again. So let's just say tonight we're probably going to get a movie. What movie are we thinking of getting now that it's out on Blu-ray?
We tried to get Ender's Game.
Yes, so...
Hopefully it's there. I really want to see it.
So I've heard it's not that great, but let's get it out on Blu-ray anyway tonight if it's available.
We might want to do, like, another podcast about it.
Yeah, so what we're going to do is I've got Ender's Game Alive, which is like an audio book... No, an audio play production. It's like a seven hour full cast audio version.
I think they have that in German too, actually.
Or the Ender's Alive,
yes.
Or just the Ender's Game.
No, a play.
Ender's Game Alive, whatever.
Yeah.
Which is actually written by Orson Scott Card. So we're going to do that. And you said you were going to read The Ender's Shadow. Was that the one you were going to see? Didn't you find that in the library? Which is told from, it's the same story, but told from
from
Bean's point of view.
Maybe I can find it.
I've read that already, but I think that might be a good fun thing to do is to do a full Ender's Game episode. I already did a review of Ender's Game, but it wasn't a proper SFBRP episode on Ender's Game.
Okay.
It was a review that I did, there it is, look. So it was a review that I did for a different podcast and then just dropped it into the feed later on.
Oh, okay.
So this can be a full review of the book, the audio play, and maybe the End of Shadow, and talking about the whole thing. So that could be a fun discussion.
Sounds
we'll
good.
Do that once we've finished those things off. But let's watch the movie first. It'll be
what
fun.
About rating?
Oh, yeah, let's get back to inversions. Yeah, let's go to it. What are you going to give it?
I was giving, like, I felt so much. I really enjoyed it, and I wanted to give it five stars. But then I was thinking back, what other books did I give five stars?
No, don't. This is not how you rate the book. Your own personal subjective enjoyment.
Okay.
How much enjoyment did you get out of this book while you're reading?
While reading,
and when you finished it, you know, thinking back.
I read about, let's say, 300 pages within a day, or even more.
You got through it quite quickly.
I give it five stars.
Really? Yeah. This will be a five-star book for you.
Yeah.
Oh, see, I was going to give this five stars as well now, but then it feels a bit too, oh, look, it's a good culture novel book and stuff like that.
You just said rate it as you enjoyed it.
I enjoyed the parts that I read as an ebook. I enjoyed the parts that I listened to as an audiobook, and quite a lot of it, actually, maybe five chapters or something, I was reading along with the audiobook, listening to the audiobook and reading along at the same time. Cool. Well, it kind of works out, but I read a bit quicker than the audiobook was there.
Obviously.
But with the adjustable time on the Audible app, I could, if I put Peter Kenny on 1.5 times or whatever it was, he was reading at a speed where I didn't feel like I had to read ahead and see what was coming up next and stuff like that.
But do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's a five-star book, but then again, I'm saying, like, now you're trying to say, is it better than this book? Or is it better? Yeah. But that's not what stars are. Like, there can be, how many star books did I say, because I made this thing with the SF, I made this thing that counted the stars and plotted them on a graph. Like, what's not a four-star book? Is it going to be that or is it going to be this? It's like, well, they both can be four-star books for different reasons.
And I really enjoyed it.
Okay, five-star book. This is now the third five-star book from culture series. So, again, this is why I think this is my my favorite series. So, that's it. Anything else to say? You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I get. If you've got a book, if you're a promoter or an author or anything like that, or a publisher, that you have a book that you want me to read, don't ask. Just don't. Just don't even bother. I'm getting 3 book review requests a day now, roughly. And I normally reply to every single one of those book review requests, book submissions and things. I have a form letter that I can just type something in very quickly in it, and it does the form letter. But even that's getting too annoying now. They're just to reply to everyone, because then they reply, oh, thanks for replying. And I'm like, I'm not replying. It's a form letter. You're sending me spam. I'm sending you spam. And then even that takes too much time. So just don't send me stuff. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Alec Birch. And also you can become my friend and Juliana's friend and everybody else's friend on goodreads.com. And you can follow along with what we're reading. And also the good thing is then we can see what you read.
And how you rate it. Give the review of it.
Yeah, so like, for example, on inversions, we can see that friends of mine give it a 3.67 average, which is because they probably didn't pick up on what we did. But maybe after listening to this podcast, you'll pick up on some more stuff that we enjoyed about this book. Anything else, or should we just say goodbye?
I think that's it.
Okay, then let's say goodbye. You go first.
Okay, goodbye, everybody.
And we'll catch you next time.